My name's David Wood.
I'm Chair of London Futurist, and shortly we'll hear from Mike Power about this fascinating subject. I'd like to say a few things about London Futurist first. How many people are here for the first time for a London Futurist meeting? Some faces I don't recognise, so a few, and I guess there may be two-thirds have been here already to a previous meeting. So whilst some of the other latecomers arrive, I'll just say a few things about what we're trying to do here. We're looking at some radical scenarios, things which could be quite different in the next, I say here, 3 to 40 years. And we want to look at them, not just for entertainment purposes, we want to look at them quite seriously. We want to find out what's technically feasible, as opposed to just being some nice journalistic story or being some Hollywood science fiction. And one way to find out what's technically feasible is to look at what's already here. And that's what we're going to be doing today, looking at what's already here and maybe talking about what might be here in the relatively near future. Figuring out what's desirable or undesirable about it, because many of these technological trends are very significant upsides, but also potentially very significant downsides. And we have to figure out, okay, do we really want to end up in this world? And if the world's going in that direction anyway, what can we do to modify it so it's a bit more pleasant for us? And then we want to, some of us at least, look at, well, how can we accelerate and enable the positive outcomes and take some measures to stop ourselves ending up in the negative outcomes? That's the big picture. There's a whole series of speaker meetings organised. The one that's happening in 2 weeks' time, I think in this same room, will be by Anish Mohammed, a former colleague of mine, who's going to talk about some of his experiences at a place called the Singularity University. Manish, were you at the Singularity University as well, yes? How long did you stay there?
I just went there for 6 days for their FutureNet program.
6 days, right. So Anish was there for 9 weeks, I believe. So he's going to talk about what he learned there about some of the rapidly changing technologies and possible ways to grow businesses that would impact 1 billion people. That's the vision of Singularity University. That's the next speaker meeting that's organized. We're actually organizing a rather bigger meeting. We're aiming for about 250 people at a meeting which is taking place in March. So I'm going to start just saying a few things about that in case those of you haven't heard about it yet. It's when we look more seriously at what might happen in 2025, jointly organized by London Futurist and the International Humanity Plus movement. We're going to look at various potential visions, roadmaps, blocks to get into 2025. And we're going to look at some of the politics, the philosophy, the activism, and the health going with it too. And if I very briefly just run through some of the speakers who are already lined up for that, we have the First Lady of Transhumanism, Natasha Vita-Moore, who in 1983 already published a Transhuman Manifesto looking at how humans would be changed by technology in terms of our bodies, in terms of our health. We have Aubrey de Grey, who is quite well known for his vision of building longer life, super longevity. He thinks that by 2025, we won't yet have longevity for humans, but we'll have done it for mice. We'll have demonstrated, you know, there's not such a thing as natural death, and so we'll have a mice living much, much longer due to interventions midway through their lives. And people will realize, hey, this isn't just some pipe dream. So he'll talk about that. We have Mark Stevenson, who is a very interesting author. He's an optimistic guy. He's written a book called The Optimist Tour of the Future, in which he interviewed a great deal of technologists, and he wrote it all down. He's working on a new book called Why Our Systems Are Failing and What Will Replace Them. We have Simon Bransfield Garth, who is an ex-colleague of mine from the mobile technology world, and he's now very much involved in applying modern technology, mobile phones, but also solar technology, transforming the lives of people all over Africa. So he'll be speaking on Empowering Africa at this conference in Birkbeck in March. We'll have David Pearce, who will be talking about some ways a little bit similar to the topic of today. He'll be talking about how we can not just enhance ourselves to be stronger, but we can enhance our mental capacities by, as he puts it, chemistry of various sorts, and how we could enjoy greater bliss and abolish all suffering, in fact. And there are lots of dangers to abolishing suffering, because we might just all sit around all day long being couch potatoes, blissing out, but he'll be talking about that. He's also the co-founder of the World Transhumanist Association. We'll have Anders Sandberg, who hasn't yet given a title, but he's the one person I know who can give an absolutely fascinating talk about any subject under the sun. He's at the Future of Humanity Institute in Oxford. He'll be speaking as well, as will Ben McLeish. Some of you may have heard of the Zeitgeist Movement. Zeitgeist Movement is all about changing philosophy about society. They don't believe there should be money. They believe that we should be living in a much more collaborative way, central planning, except that you don't do it too centrally. Anyway, he's a fascinating speaker. He'll be talking about updating technical values and hacking culture lag. Things to culture, we've got lags way behind what's possible. We'll also have Manish. Ah, Manish, sitting in the back of the room there, yeah? Who is a digital health futurist and the chapter leader of Health 2.0 London. And he'll be talking about healthcare in the future and all the things that might make doctors unemployed. Not because there's no diseases anymore, but because robots and the big data will be doing that instead. Eamon Calkin is the founder of Zero State, which is a movement dedicated to improving society by technology. He'll be speaking on what he thinks the convergent trends are in 2025. And Vladimirov described himself as a DIY brain hacker. He hacks his brains in a different way to the way in which Mike is going to talk about. He puts electrical stimulation around his head, and he's got magnetic fields and various other things, which he believes makes him smarter. And he believes there's objective evidence for that. There is a growing movement in this, so he'll be talking about the near future of accessible cognition enhancement and modification. We'll also have Callum. He's written a fascinating novel, not yet released, on the growth of artificial intelligence. He'll be talking about some of the big issues in that. Reva Melissa Tez is working with many startups, giving them marketing advice. She'll be talking about obstacles that she sees that prevent emerging technologies from fulfilling their potential. And lastly, there's another person who's here today who'll also be speaking, and that's me. Oh gosh, it says here I'm a smartphone pioneer and chair London futurist, so it's on the screen, so it must be true. Anyway, I'll be talking about some, not about the future so much, but how people have predicted the future in the past, and how we've often got it wrong when we predicted the future, and why people get it wrong when predicting the future. And I'll be talking about various roadblocks that we face en route to this very positive 2025 future. So that's all I say in March. In case you can't wait for more discussions, some of these future technologies, you're going to get some today. We also do various hangouts on air, which means people don't have to congregate in the same physical space. These are done by courtesy of Google, and there are four speakers who will be all talking about the subject of cryonics, which is the idea that we might suspend people when they are near death, or even when they are legally dead, and we might be able to, in some stage in the future, bring them back to life, reanimate them. Garrett almost looks like he's been suspended already in this picture. I'm told that picture of him was drawn by a robot, so he's quite pleased with that. So Garrett and Max Moore, in fact, we're in the 1980s here in the UK. They set up a cryonics institute here. And the question is, why hasn't it taken off? And what factors are changing in technology, which might mean there's going to be a surge in interest in that? So that's a one hangout on air. We generally run these in the UK at 7 o'clock onwards on Sundays. And there's several more that you'll read about on our website. Nicole, question?
Those March 22nd and 23rd, will they be
full-day
conferences?
They are two all-day conferences.
Conference.
The only way I can get 18 speakers in is by starting it at 9:15 and finishing at 5 o'clock.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's all tickets to that event. You have to insist that people get their tickets in advance.
And it's here?
Well, it's actually over there. Floor.
Okay.
It's in the Clover building. They've got a nice big lecture theatre in the bottom floor that does 250. And without any more ado, it's long overdue that I hand over to the main speaker for the day. The web revolution that's changing how the world gets high. And there are many, many implications that we're going to dig into as a result. So let's say welcome, Mike.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's nice to see so many people, surprising to see so many people actually to come out and talk about a subject as arcane as the internet and psychoactive drug. Okay, so the talk's going to last about half an hour. It's going to travel all over the world. So my name is Mike Power. I wrote a book just recently called Drugs 2.0, The Web Revolution That's Changing How the World Gets High. And I specialise in drugs and technology. That's what fascinates me and that's what I write about. And I suppose this talk today has a theme. It's a theme of change. And we've read a lot in recent years about legal highs, and you know, I think that that's a really good place to start in this discussion. So rather than the rather high-minded academic kind of opening that we have, we'll have instead popular culture. Drugs are part of popular culture, they always have been. Going back to the 1960s, if we look at when drugs first came into the popular culture, maybe it will give us a place from which to start and to plot our narrative arc and to see the trajectory. And if we start and if we think about, let's say, the Beatles, you know, that was probably when most people in sort of British society came across a pop star or a kind of a culture that was involved with drugs. And so when people think of the Beatles and they think of drugs, the first substance I think that most people might have in their minds would be, what, maybe LSD, yeah? And, you know, most people would think that. But in fact, the first experience that the Beatles had without, you know, a non-alcohol buzz, it was actually, according to the world's most respected Beatles historian, a guy called Mark Lewison, it was Benzedrine. And Benzedrine was a legal high in the day. It was a stimulant drug that was found inside nasal inhalers. And the Beatles would crack open the tubes and they'd suck on the stimulant soaked insides and they'd get a buzz from that. And that was the first buzz they ever had. So the Beatles' first drug experience was a legal high. And it gave them a taste for more. But the first drug that the Beatles really abused, the one that they all took, it was a different drug. It was another legal high. It was called phenmetrazine. And phenmetrazine has the trade name Preludin. And so, here we go. This is a little known picture of the Beatles. Not many of you will have seen it, I imagine. And what do we see in that photo? We see John Lennon. They may even be on phenmetrazine in this photo. This is Pete Best, not Ringo. There's Mr. Lennon, gurning, gritting his teeth. There's George Harrison holding the tube, and we can see here it says Preludin. And this was a photograph taken in 1962. So there's the Beatles, one of the first documented, in fact it's the only documented picture of the Beatles with a drug connection, explicitly. And this photograph really fascinated me when I came across it just recently. I thought, okay, what's this drug, what is it about? How has this picture been buried for so many years, you know, if you think of it? It actually said that Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager, it said that he kept it hidden for years. You know, and if you think about it, how different might the world have been if this evidence of the Beatles' drug abuse had actually been publicised? You know, I mean, in the US at the time, you know, sort of Perry Como, Frank Sinatra, the crooners, that was the cultural norm. And the US media was outraged simply by the fact that the Beatles, who are from my own city, Liverpool, but the Beatles had an accent and fringes, you know? So if you think of it, it's kind of, today this photo will be up on the band's Facebook page. You know, it almost makes you feel sorry for Justin Bieber, you know? You see these kids, but they got away with it because it was buried. But the Beatles were in really good company. Pep pills, amphetamines like this, they were abused by everyone from British housewives to US presidents. And so phenmetrazine, this drug, which is key to today's presentation, certainly. It was abused by the great and good. It was taken by Truman Capote. It was taken by Elvis Presley, Marilyn Monroe, and Jack Ruby, the guy that actually shot Lee Harvey Oswald. He was off his head on phenmetrazine the day that he shot Oswald. So how prevalent was this kind of drug use back in the time? In August 1966, Labour MP Rennie Short told the House of Commons, in 1965, there were 2 million prescriptions for PEP pills, so that's 2 million amphetamine prescriptions in the UK in 1965. And in 1964, there were 9 million tranquilizer prescriptions. So you can see that, you know, prescription drug abuse was a big thing there. And, you know, before we smile at those antiquated times, it's really quite revealing, I think, to look at the worldwide contemporary use of Adderall, which is the ADHD medicine. Now, the year that I've got figures for that, in 2010 in the US, there were prescriptions for 84 tons of amphetamines in the US. So, you know, that's a drug that's active at 20 milligrams. That means that 1 gram has got 50 doses and 1 kilo has got 50,000 doses. And this is 84,000 kilos. It's quite a lot. So phenmetrazine came in these tubes, in these small tubes, and they were pressed tablets, and they each contained about 25 milligrams of active product. The Beatles were given it by girls who worked in the cloakrooms, in the Star Club, and each of the band would take 1 or 2, but John Lennon liked to have a lot, he'd have 4 or 5. So phenmetrazine, when it was abused, was an intensely euphoric drug. It was a very powerful stimulant. And it kept you going for hours. It enabled the Beatles to turn out set after set, night after night, 12 hours of rock and roll. And it helped them hone their art, and along with a skinful of German beer, it helped them deal with crowds of drunken sailors. And it was their time in Hamburg that helped them become the band that conquered the world. Their time in Hamburg changed them, and it changed the way they looked, the way they sounded, and the way they behaved. And it's this drug, phenmetrazine, that inspired my latest investigation into legal highs and the way that the web is changing international drug markets. So why am I interested in this particular story, drugs and technology? It goes back to 2008, to the photograph that David showed. When I was living in Colombia, I was a correspondent out there, and I was really interested in the cocaine story. I thought it wasn't written in much detail in the UK, and it wasn't particularly well studied. And at that time, Colombia was producing over 600 tons of cocaine a year, 600 tons, that's 60%. And the cocaine was tied in very closely with the Marxist insurrection, the civil war there, which in many discourses is presented as a terrorist uprising, but it's a civil war. So the guerrilla in Colombia financed part of their they financed part of their campaign with the export of cocaine, and by taxing farmers who grew the coca leaves on their territory. So I decided I wanted to visit a cocaine plantation in Colombia. So I went to meet the local mayor in Cartagena, where I was living, and I persuaded the local mayor to allow me to go to a cocaine plantation. And so, at that time, the United Nations were attempting to eradicate cocaine from Colombia by bringing in arrancadores. And an arrancador is these guys. That's a cocaine plantation in the upper Magdalena Valley of Colombia. And I went there with these guys. It was an amazing experience. And they're digging up the coca plants. This is the leaf that makes cocaine. And I spent the day there, and it was a really very, very enlightening experience to spend time in a cocaine plantation and to meet the cocalero, the guy that grows the cocaine. And I got some facts for you, some figures, and I said, okay, so in this field, this is a hectare, what can you get from this field? And he said, okay, if you've got this one field, you can get 5 to 6 kilos of pasta básica, which is a raw cocaine. And that can then be refined down to like 4 or 5 kilos of cocaine hydrochloride. And I said, okay, so how much did you sell that for? He said, $1,500 a kilo. That's a kilo of cocaine for $1,500. That's the farm gate price in Colombia. I was interested in this, and I thought about it, checked out when I got back to the UK. And that cocaine in the UK is cut down by 5 times. It ends up as 5 kilos from one field, ends up as 25 kilos. And then, you know, each of those kilos are sold wholesale in the UK at £30,000. That's the price for a kilo of cocaine. So $1,500 to £30,000. These are the economics of the drugs trade. And so that means that one field in Colombia gives the farmer about $5,000, and retail prices of cocaine are £50 a gram in the UK, so it's £50,000. So you go from $1,500 to £50,000 in 2 steps. So the economics of this fascinated me, and I thought about it, and it's like, you know, that's from one field. You're looking at £1.25 million from one field of cocaine. And so that's from one field, and there are hundreds of thousands of fields like this all over Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, and Colombia, everywhere. So, you know, I'm in the field, it's quite a hectic day. This is the kind of scene that we had. These guys, you know, they were protecting us. We were all shaking from exhaustion and dehydration, and there were bomb dogs, sort of perimeter, sort of snipers. It was a crazy scene. And I found the guy whose field it was, and I said to him, okay, so what will you do? We're destroying your livelihood, you know, we're pulling up all of your plants, we're taking all of your cocaine away. What will you do? And he said, I'll go to the next field and I'll plant some around. And I said, okay, talk me through that. And he said, well, and I'll quote directly, he said, as soon as they're gone, I'll be planting more coca. He said, I'd like to grow more coffee, but that takes 7 years. He said, this bush grows back in 9 months. He said, and it produces leaves every 60 days. Rice sells at $25 a hundredweight. It takes 5 months of hard work, and I need to transport it by river. That costs a lot. Coca paste goes for $1,500 a kilo, and the plant needs no attention. So we've got two different plants. Rice, months of work, cocaine, $1,500, you don't need to do a thing. So, you know, from the supply side and the demand side, we're not looking at this in any kind of clear or logical way, the drugs trade. So his comment seemed to be, you know, the most instructive thing I've ever heard in the war on drugs. The guy that grows it, he knew what was happening. So previous to this in Colombia in the early part of the 2000s, the US government, in an attempt to control the cocaine trade, they had sprayed Colombia with glyphosate, which is a napalm-like substance, to wipe out the farms. But lots of other food crops were caught up in that spraying campaign. So all of these farmers who were growing the cocaine, basically they lost their livelihoods even more because their food crops were now gone. So their response was to go into the national parks. And in the national parks, it was illegal to spray the crops. But then that meant that tourism didn't come to Colombia, and the war got worse because there was no there was more cocaine being produced, there was less tourism, and the country was just in a death spiral at the early part of the 2000s. So it was an endless cycle, and it was really naive of the United Nations to believe that by pulling up the cocaine in this field, it was going to stop people snorting cocaine in Soho. It was not going to happen. And it was counterproductive, and it was futile. And our operation that day, that one field, involved hundreds of men, tens of thousands of dollars. And, you know, the farmer, when we pulled the plants up, he even told me that he found a way to plant it in the next field with molasses to actually make the crop grow. And he said it grows back even stronger. It seemed the perfect symbol of the ridiculous story. And so at the same time as this, cocaine consumption in the UK and the US and the EU was not being tackled in any meaningful way. Demand was still high. And as I was seeing the kind of the impact of its production and its prohibition all over Colombia, prices were dropping in the UK. Prices were dropping to $25,000, $20,000. So, you know, the drug moved from being the kind of thing that rock stars did to becoming really commonplace in certain circles in the UK and all over Europe. And attacking supply in Colombia did absolutely nothing to reduce demand. And in fact, it actually grew. And that circular, relentless, and slightly insane story really fascinated me. And so I started to look into it even more. So this next section of the story, to signpost you, is it's how legal highs came to prominence following my kind of research into this particular part of the drug culture. And so it's now split between Cambodia, instead of Colombia, Cambodia and the UK. So it's now June 2008 in this tranche of the story. The United Nations again decides to clamp down on the drugs market, and they clamp down on the illegal safrole industry this time in Cambodia. Now, safrole is an essential oil. It kind of smells like marzipan, and it's extracted from the roots of certain trees. It's used in the perfumery industry, and it's used in the food industry as well, and the tanning industry as well, I think. But it's also just a couple of steps in a decent laboratory from safrole to MDMA, ecstasy, the third most popular recreational drug in the UK and in the EU. It's used by 500,000 people a week in the UK, which is a huge market. And so, you know, there's lots of different ways to make MDMA, but the route using safrole is favoured because of its simplicity. It's very straightforward. It's also one of the most watched substances on the planet. If you go to Alibaba or Google, any part of these international sites, and you buy safrole, you'll be arrested within a day or two. It's on a watch list, and you'll be immediately arrested, so don't do that. Safrole is extracted from the roots of the yellow camphor tree. You know, I mean, all drugs really, if you look at it, start from a natural source in one way or another. It's really easy to make MDMA in the jungle of Cambodia. What you do is you go into the jungle, you cut down the canopy, you cut down the forest, you hack your way through, and then you use that wood to burn underneath a large sort of cauldron. And these cauldrons look like this. That's a cauldron full of the roots of a yellow camphor tree. And you steam distill the bark of the root. And that gives you a yellow liquid, a viscous liquid that is made into MDMA. And so, you know, the UN decided to tackle this, and they go into Cambodia and they steam through the jungle and they stop the industry. And suddenly the war on drugs is won and there's no more drugs made. Well, no, that's not the truth. Well, what happened at that point was they destroyed 33 tons of safrole in 2008. And there's the Sydney Morning Herald reporting that $7 billion ecstasy oil stash goes up in smoke. Now, I'd been trawling the web and looking into MDMA supply. I'd always been interested in it because I found that whenever the MDMA supply was actually low in the UK, a toxic replacement would take its place. And it was no different on this occasion. This was enough MDMA to feed the entire European market in 2008. It was enough to make 245 million tablets of ecstasy. So if you think of 500,000 people using it in the UK, 245 million tablets were destroyed on this day. All oil to do that was destroyed on this day. So it's 2008, Cambodia's burning oil. And at the same time, the credit crunch is biting. Money is in enormously short supply all across the world. The credit markets have dried up. Consequence of that was that the pound lost 25% of its value against the dollar and the euro. And these are the currencies in which you buy cocaine. So on top of an MDMA drought, where suddenly, to give you some some measure of that, seizures in Europe were down to a quarter of their normal levels. Excuse me. So what you had was a situation where there was no ecstasy and no cocaine in the UK. Now, whether or not you take ecstasy or cocaine, you know, it's of no interest to me, and it should be of no interest to anyone. But there was suddenly a complete gap in the market, and it needed to be filled, because if you think of how many people are involved in the financial side of it, you know, just from the cocaine, one field, 1.25 million equation we had before, there was money to be made. And so at this point, that was when a new drug appeared in the UK, and it was a drug called methadrone. Methadrone was a drug which had never been seen on international drug markets before. It was a kind of amphetamine, a kind of cathinone, and it was a legal high. It was a legal drug that was made specifically to replicate the effects of ecstasy and cocaine. And I was the first journalist in the world to write about that. And it was cheap, pure, strong, effective, and incredibly timely. And it became the fourth most popular drug in the UK within a few months of going on sale. If there's more time, I'll tell you all about that story, but I'm sure that many of you know it. But the real story was that I'd spotted the new trend in drug culture, and that was the emergence of legal highs. That's chemicals that mimicked banned drugs, but differed by just a molecule or two to make them legal. So as ecstasy and cocaine quality vanished and disappeared, through came a legal high in 2008. There's a long story behind that, which is in my book, Drugs 2.0. So at that time, to bring in like a connection with the internet and to tie those two things together, the thing that really fascinated me at that point was that you had these editorials in newspapers such as The Telegraph, and they would say, you know, this killer drug must be wiped out, this evil psychedelic menace must be stamped down upon. And at the bottom of the website would be an advert for somebody offering to sell you the drug. You know, so you've got moral panic on the one side, but then click to buy now on the other. That struck me as a really interesting tension, and that was because of Google AdWords, Google AdSense, where drug dealers bought the word methadrone from Google, and advertisers paid Google for AdWords, and so the two packages informed each other. And after the word methadrone appeared on a Telegraph editorial, at the bottom one day I actually saw a dialogram service. So the Daily Telegraph was advertising motorbike cocaine-like substance delivery services for about 6 months. It was incredible. It was incredibly surreal, and it felt like it was kind of a Neal Stephenson novel come to life. It was wonderful. So at this point, we had a perfect confluence of drugs and culture and technology, and each of them was changing the other at this point in 2008. And they were exerting an evolutionary pressure on each other, and they were mutating and developing in a really dynamic system. So, you know, around about that time, 2008, I don't know if you remember, it was still, you know, Facebook and Twitter were not so kind of dominant in our lives that you could still have a conversation in the pub without people checking their phone, you know. It was quite an enjoyable time. And I've been watching the rise of internet shopping and online shopping, and I knew that as, you know, as methadrone appeared in 2008 and it was sold to anyone with a credit card, I realised that we were in the middle of a really tumultuous period of change, and I decided to document it, and that is how I wrote my book, Drugs 2.0, which came out this year. I don't have any copies to sell or sign or give away, but you can buy all good tax dodgers online. So let's go back to phenmetrazine now, back to the Beatles, okay? And I'll have a sip of water while I do. So phenmetrazine. After my book was published, I decided to go a little further. I wanted to know, were the assertions that I was making in my book and were the assertions that everyone was making in their newspaper articles, were they true? Because what everyone was saying was, you know, people were saying it was a simple matter to take a banned drug, an illegal drug, and to have a modification of it made in China, and for it to retain its drug-like effects, to do a little bit of chemical molecular manipulation, and that would let you make a drug. So, you know, the newspapers would say altering drugs like cocaine and ecstasy. And it's actually not true. That is not how the legal highs market works. It's not how the marketing novel psychoactive substances are also not. That's not how it works. For example, you can't take, say, amphetamine and add fluorine to it and then make a drug that's legal. But you can make that drug, and it's very effective. It's called 2-fluoroamphetamine. But it's illegal in the UK because our drug laws are written by some really smart people. However, the drug designers are even smarter. And they're all connected online, and they're connecting communities which are uncontrollable. And I've joined those communities, both undercover and as a participant for journalistic purposes. And so basically, in order to test this hypothesis that it's a simple matter to take a banned drug and add a few molecules and make it into a legal high, we decided, I thought, well, okay, let's make a legal version of phenmetrazine. Let's go back to that photograph of the Beatles, and let's actually try to make a legal version of Preludin, the first drug that the Beatles, who were the first drug takers in popular culture, let's go all the way back there, because I thought it would really illustrate well how the drug market has changed. And so I set off. I was doing it for a great magazine, which I think a lot of you would really enjoy, called readmatter.com. It's a long-form journalistic resource that actually pays people for digital content very well, so I'll recommend it very highly. We decided to do a legal version of phenmetrazine, and we thought, we'll see how difficult it is to do. Is it possible? And so we set off, and, you know, my chemistry isn't that amazing. I've written about it, but I've had to study it. And so I had to call a few people in, a few favours, and a few people to advise me on a likely chemical modification to phenmetrazine, the Beatles' first drug. And I was given that information, and it took me a few months to find a lab. But then, you know, after Googling custom synthesis, plenty of chemical firms in China claimed they could do it. I phoned dozens of them up, and I had some really unusual conversations. I was pretending, my cover story was that I was a dog medicine manufacturer, and I was making dog medicine. I said, I'm a canine specialist in analgesics, and I want to make a medicine for dogs. Now, this was obviously a complete lie. All it took was a Gmail account. All I did was set up a Gmail account, emailed the guy and said, I want to make this thing. So in the end, it took me a while, about a month of failure and attempted rip-offs and all kinds of people from Cameroon and Ukraine and everywhere telling me they could do this for me, it's not a problem. I got fed up and I had to ask someone else. I said, look, tell me a decent lab that's not going to rip me off. I've got a deadline on this story. I need to get it written. And I was given the name and the number of the lab that I'm about to show now. And if I can ask Brian to possibly pause that camera. And anyone, I don't want these photos going online. We live in a tiny world nowadays. The next photos are photographs of the laboratory that made the legal drug for me. And I'm going to go through them very quickly. The reason I'm being so cautious is because China has the death penalty, and it's, you know, unintended consequences shouldn't really extend to someone's life. So the next three images are to show you really quickly that it's a very professional outfit. It's not, you know, some backstreet chemist. It was this laboratory here that sent me them. There's one, there's two, there's three, with all of the bits cut out, and we're back here. Okay. So it's a proper lab. It's a proper pharmaceutical lab. They make pharmaceutical intermediates, and yeah, we're back if you need to.
I didn't see it actually.
Oh, good. Even better. So that's my lab. It's in Shanghai. I was in touch with the guy every other day. Do we have any chemists in the room? A bit. Okay. Well, that what we see there is it's an HPLC reading, isn't it? So anyway, it took me a few weeks to get things sorted. But basically, what we decided to do, we decided to take phenmetrazine, the stimulant, and to add what's called a methyl group to it. A methyl group is carbon and three hydrogens. So it's three atoms of carbon and hydrogen, and just by adding that to the phenmetrazine skeleton, we made a legal version of it. We actually did it, and there it is there, it's made. Now, this meant that the drug would still be legal in the UK, and it would actually still probably act as a stimulant. And in truth, we didn't actually make phenmetrazine and then add that molecular group to it. We followed a different recipe, a different synthesis that resulted in that particular legal modification of that drug being available. So the lab mailed me back in a few weeks, and they sent me this one, which is HPLC, and then they sent me this one, which is the NMR. That's the nuclear magnetic resonance reading of it. This is that bit there. That's what makes it legal. That. If it was just that, it wouldn't be legal. It would be illegal as a Class B drug under the British Misuse of Drugs Act 1971. By adding that, it's completely legal. And probably, I would say, still active. Well, actually, I know it's still active because the guy that told me, people have asked me if I tried it.
No. Right.
Sorry? Oh, yeah, I fed it to some dogs. Yeah. So they'd still be running now. No, the guy that gave me the synthesis, he told me that he tried it himself in the 1980s. You know, he tried the drug himself. He's an experimental chemist. So the lab said to me that purity was 95%, and it was ready for me to have delivered. And so I needed to get it in the country. I needed to become an international drug smuggler. So I grasped my metal, and I asked them to deliver it. And they said, okay, we can deliver it. And they were amazing. They were really good. They were actually better than Tesco. You know, they didn't tell me a time that I needed to be home. They didn't give me a delivery slot. They were just really good. I said, you know, this is included in the price of the synthesis, and they sent it to me. And I had to choose a delivery spot, and that was easy to kind of receive my, you know, semi-legal drugs through the international mail. Was quite an easy task. I went to a local mailboxes firm, and I gave them a false name, paid in cash, got a key, had a box, job done. So we arranged delivery by a really well-known courier firm, who I won't name, and the lab offered to send it to me, and they said that they can hide it inside a book. And I said, well, why are you hiding it in a book when it's legal? And he didn't say anything. And it was obvious that between us there was this complicity that, you know, phenmetrazine is a famously abusable stimulant. If you Google the words phenmetrazine, the third link that comes up, perhaps, for each of us, but for me, when it comes up, it says the world's most abusable stimulant, yeah? There's been films written about how wonderful it is. There's been all kinds of stuff. So, you know, it came to the UK. I plotted it. I actually tracked it online. I tracked it. I was watching it through the day, dropping off in the different delivery stations. And I thought, I bet there's not many drug smugglers who've actually plotted their course of their drugs across the world. And I thought that might be a kind of change in the way that the drug deals are done in the future. So the lab sent it to me as metal cleaning powder. In fact, it was a metal cleaning power, actually, which made me a little bit paranoid. So I went to collect it, which was, again, paranoia-inducing, because none of us want to get on the tube with a bag of white powder in our pocket. But I collected it, and I got it home, and I photographed it. And there it is. A bag of a specially commissioned, legally synthesized drug that circumvents the British Misuse of Drugs Act 1971 by one carbon atom and three hydrogens. Atoms, we're talking atomic level legal circumvention. So that's that. So, you know, all I really had to do now was sort of wonder to myself how it hadn't been opened. Well, obviously it wouldn't be opened. It's one of several million pieces of mail that go through international handling every day. And the business model of companies like FedEx and DHL depends on a business model that means they can have things delivered overnight. To carry out the next stage of the investigation that I did was to have the drug tested. If they wanted to test it, their business model would be broken. So currently, right now, international courier companies are being used to deliver drugs all over the world, and I know this for a fact. I watch people selling kilos of cocaine using FedEx, using DHL, every other day of my life. So this is the world we live in. So all I had to do was to test it. And so I got in touch with a brilliant chemist, a guy called Andrew Westall, who works at Wedenos. Wedenos is a Welsh government initiative set up by a contact of mine, Dr. David Caldicott. It's toxicosurveillance. It tracks the emergence of novel psychoactive substances in societies, plots them, we learn about them, and then we study and we find ways to avoid people dying from them, because this is the ultimate consequence. Let's not do a scare story. Not all drugs will kill you, but, you know, drugs such as this are untested on any animal known to man. So I sent it off to Andrew Westwell, the chemist at Wedenos, and he got back to me and he said, yeah. He said, the beetle has landed. He said, you've got a very pure sample of this particular variant of phenmetrazine. He said, the lab had done exactly as we liked, and we imagine that, you know, the Beatles would have been quite happy about that. So that's how I made the legal version of phenmetrazine, Preludin, the first drug that the Beatles took. And the question is, really, we were asking, you know, how easy is it? What's the central premise of the investigation was, how easy is it? And really, it depends on your viewpoint. In the words of the guy that set up Wedenos, the Welsh toxicosurveillance agency, David Caldicott said to me, it's like concierge drug design. He said, it's like room service, just choosing a drug from a menu. And that's true. But without being boastful, nobody here today could actually, well, possibly, could have done this within the time frame I did. This took me 6 weeks, working day and night. Now, I've been working on stories like this for 5 years since I first covered methadone. I've made a lot of contacts, and I've done a lot of research and learning, and I know clandestine chemists and criminals. These are people that I know from my work. I would argue that anyone, actually, if I can do it, anyone could if they spent some time on it. And that's the real change, that's the real difference going forward, is that this wasn't possible before the web. This wasn't possible before globalization, before the rise of China as an exporter. It wasn't possible. Now it is. And so, you know, people are doing it, and they are doing it right now, and they will continue to do it. And it was easy for me to do this investigation in certain ways because I could spend a lot of time on it. I was well paid, and I could dedicate myself to it day and night. And legally, it was very easy, indeed, because, you know, it's impossible to legislate for every substance and every modification in the world. So it's you know, the catch-all laws that sort of ban molecular manipulation are too hard to write. And I think this is the key, really, to the whole issue, is that you can ban drugs, but you can't ban chemistry. You cannot ban chemistry. And if you want to shut down the web, then you'd have to shut down business, banking, health services, and you can just, you know, basically forget that as an option. So practically, how difficult was it? It was complete simplicity. I needed a phone, an internet connection, and a PO box. That's all I needed. I could have done this from an internet cafe for £1 an hour. I could have done it on Tottenham Court Road for £1. Yeah, it wouldn't have been hard. So in terms of personal danger, there was none. There was absolutely none. The lad didn't know my real name. They didn't know anything about me. All they knew was my made-up email address, and I connected to the internet using Tor, so it didn't even have my IP address. So, if I wanted to, you know, I mean, this is the point. The real point is, though, it's not really about how easy it is. It's about the motivation. And let's look at the motivation. Let's go back to money, because it's always about the money. If I wanted to sell this drug, if I were a legal highs vendor in the UK, I could sell this drug, you know, for a lot of money. The motivations would be high and the reward would be high. Here's some numbers again. I could sell this drug for at least £50 a gram, probably more. And I would probably think, looking at the way that the market's moved in the last few years, I could probably get 6 months or a year before it was banned outright. Now, I've calculated that I could make at least a 50-fold return on my investment. 50-fold return on my investment. That's better than cocaine. Yeah? Much better than cocaine. And I know the drug will work because the guy that's given me the recipe told me he'd tried it and it works. Now, given the right kind of hype from newspapers, from politicians and other moral panic merchants, you know, or if supplies of MDMA and cocaine vanished overnight as they did in 2008, and if it was as powerful and popular as methadone, the drug that kicked off the legal high cycle that we're in the middle of, if all of those conditions were met, and why wouldn't it be, then I'd only need to sell 20 kilos and I'd be a millionaire. 20 kilos. I could fit enough drug on that table and I could import it legally and sell it. Simple job. So the question of ease really is kind of irrelevant. The question instead should be one of motivation. And under current legal paradigms, it's actually a rational business decision to get involved in this industry. The ethics, on the other hand, are a completely different matter. So, you know, I'd like to illustrate what the story means. We have the what. We know what's happening. What does the story mean? What's the impact of this? And to me, the impact of it is best, again, served by looking back to the 1960s. Let's look back to 1969, when over 500,000 people went to Woodstock. There was 500,000 people there, and it was a week-long orgy of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You know, fantastic. So, how many people do you think died at Woodstock? Anyone guess? How many people died at Woodstock in a week-long fiesta of sex, drugs, rock and roll?
About 20.
Okay, two. Two people died, and two people died. One died from heroin overdose, and one person died by being run over by a tractor, yeah? And that's 500,000 people. Now, in September in 2013, so just a few weeks ago, a guy called Jonathan Graham, he's an IT manager from Chelmsford, England, and he was described by his friends and colleagues as Mr. Dependable. You can imagine the guy. He's a 33-year-old IT guy from Chelmsford, yeah? And he was at the Brownstock Festival. So not he's at Woodstock, he's at Brownstock in South Wood and Ferrers in Essex. And there were just 5,000 people present. So do the maths. He died at that festival, a 33-year-old man, and his post-mortem was inconclusive at the time that I wrote this, which was a few weeks ago. But his partner, who also took the drug, she had taken a legal high called 5-EAPB. She was hospitalised, but she survived. So where did that drug come from? Well, on June the 10th, 2013, 6-APB, which is a drug similar to MDMA, that came in following the UN's clampdown on MDMA. 6-APB, which is, you know, very similar to MDMA in many ways, was banned in the UK. A drug called 5-MAPB, a methyl group different. same as my vimetrazine analog, just slightly different. That came to the market one day later, one day after the drug was banned, a new one came to the market. And then the same day as that drug was banned, which was a few weeks later, two new drugs, 5-EAPB and 6-EAPB, appeared. 5-EAPB is the drug that killed Mr. Dependable. So, what's the government's response to this phenomenon of legal highs actually been? It's, you know, both Labour and Conservative. It's been wholly inadequate, in my opinion. When methadone first appeared in 2010, the Labour government ignored its own advisory council on the misuse of drugs. They did not listen to them, and there were a number of sackings and resignations that year. And this was a huge missed opportunity, in my view. The Tories introduced something called temporary class drug orders, TCDOs, in November 2011, whereby a drug can be temporarily controlled for a year, and it can be banned once the ACMD has pondered its harms. But the law has done nothing, that law has done nothing to slow down chemical innovation. Since there's a family of drugs, super potent psychedelics called the MBOMA series of psychedelics, they're active at 100 micrograms, that's more powerful than any psychedelic on the market other than LSD. So this is a drug that's active. The MBOMA series of hallucinogenic drugs are active. 1 gram contains 5,000 doses, and it's legal in China, and it can be imported into the UK and sold. And so that was banned in the summer under a TCDO. But then the same week, a new family of equipotent hallucinogens came out, and they were the MBOH series. It's like an alphabet soup of constant innovation. So some numbers for you now. In 2009, the year after the first appearance of methadone, when I first documented methadone in the world, 24 new drugs appeared that year. Now, the year before, it was about 10. In 2010, 41 new drugs appeared. In 2011, 49 new drugs appeared. And in 2012, there were 73 more. So we have a tripling in the prevalence and proliferation of novel psychoactive substances following government legislative attempts to clamp this industry down. By October 2013, just a few weeks ago, another 56 compounds had already been identified. That is a total of 243 new compounds in just 4 years. So actually it's 244 if you count mine, because I've just made a new one. That's 244 new drugs have appeared. Now, actually it's 247, yeah? Because there's three new drugs I'm looking into, and it's like this every day, there's a new drug appears. Two of the new drugs are legal versions of LSD. There they are, there's one. Now that's for sale online right now. It's about £4 or £5 a tab. AL, a lad, it's an ergoloid. It's a slight variant on LSD. Lasts exactly the same amount of time. It has all of the same qualities, downfalls, whatever you choose to see them as. But there it is, there's ALD. So while I was actually, you know, while I was writing this story.
What's the dosage on that tab?
On that tab, the dosage is claimed to be 150 micrograms. But the way that highly potent psychoactives are laid onto blotter, they call it laying.
Yeah.
You mix the powder with ethanol and you pour it onto a blotter, and or you drop it and then it evaporates. But this can, you know, this is not a pharmaceutical industry, you know. It's a clandestine chemistry. So this one might have 150 on, this one might have 200, this one might have 400. It's not exactly like that, but it's, you know, laying blotter. Some people are incredibly adept at it. Members of the Grateful Dead sort of audience, the Grateful Dead fans, are fantastic at laying blotter. They can, they're like machines, you know, they can lay it really well. So while I was actually, you know, going off and doing this doing this investigation, someone was actually copying me in a way in real life. While I was doing my theoretical, fictional investigation, a theoretical custom synthesis of a 1960s drug, someone had gone off and done the same thing in reality. And that drug is now on sale. Now, you know, I don't want this to be an alarmist or a kind of, you know, in any way kind of sensational talk. I don't see that the issue as being that complicated. I think that, you know, we need to look at why these drugs are appearing. Why are these drugs appearing? Why do we have 247 new drugs in the last 4 years? And to me, it's really simple. It's that, you know, we're confusing cause and effect on a completely epic scale. And the reason that these drugs exist, the legal highs, the alternatives to the drugs that have been banned, is because of drug laws. And the reason that more drugs are appearing now than ever before is because we're banning more of them than ever before. And so, you know, that's if you're just talking about legal highs. The internet drug market is not just about legal highs. Now, it's actually about, as probably many of us know, illegal drugs, and illegal drugs can be got on the internet and on the web just as easily as legal highs. Simple. How many people have heard of the Silk Road? Yes, I thought so. So the Silk Road. I wrote the first book-length study of the Silk Road in my book, Drugs 2.0. And at the time, you know, I knew it was going to be an enormous story, but those of you who don't know, it's an Amazon for drugs. It's like an eBay for drugs, and it just brings people together who want to buy and sell drugs. And its audacity is as staggering as the scale of its ambition. In the same way that eBay connects a man in Aberdeen who wants to sell an old boiler part to a guy that wants to buy that same boiler part in Kent, well, the Silk Road can connect a Norwegian vendor of psychedelic magic mushrooms to a man that wants to buy them in rural France. And they buy them and post them to each other. Simply done. Here's how the site looks for you, those of you who haven't been there. What have we got there? Different kinds of marijuana, different kinds of ketamine, some kind of, you know, psychedelics, anything you want there. Anything you want. It's accessed by a Tor. The Tor browser. Who uses the Tor browser here? Does anyone know the Tor browser? We've got one or two, three. No surprise in a room of futurists. And so, the things that make it possible, you know, the sale of illegal drugs across the internet is Bitcoin, Tor, and encryption. And so, you know, the anonymous currency Bitcoin, and you'll have read a lot about it in the news over the last few weeks and months, it's an anonymous peer-to-peer currency that's used like PayPal. And the only difference is that, you know, nobody knows your name, nobody knows your account details, and you can buy Bitcoins from exchanges, you can buy them anonymously in cash, and you can mine them by allowing your computer to maintain a public ledger of all Bitcoin transactions known as the blockchain. It's a decentralized public ledger of Bitcoin transactions, and it ensures that each Bitcoin is spent only once. The way that works is by solving cryptographic puzzles or hashes that enable each transaction and maintain the ledger, this decentralized ledger, and it, you know, that creates coins. So there's a whole kind of talks worth of material on Bitcoin, and it's not what I'm going to do today, it's for my next book. My next book is actually going to be about the dark web. The dark web is the same as the normal web. It's a hidden network of pages and services located on servers around the world. And instead of being indexed by Google, the names are kind of scrambled and hidden. And so, you know, the way that Tor connects you to the web is by encrypting your connection from you to the endpoint, and no one in the middle can observe what you're doing. So that's how Tor is used to connect to the dark web. And so, basically, I mean, Tor is an interesting story. It was actually created by the US Navy originally to enable the US Navy to avoid traffic analysis and to communicate privately without any oversight. But the problem was that only the Navy was using it. So if you've got an anonymous cloak and everyone else has got one, then there's no anonymity. So you need a crowd to hide in. And so Roger Dingledink, the brilliant US mathematician, released it to the web. And nowadays it's used by anyone that wants to be anonymous online. So these are the things that make the dark web Silk Road possible. So as you likely know, the Silk Road actually closed down on October the 2nd. And there it is. October the 2nd, the site was closed down. This hidden site was seized. And in the background, you can see the FBI having a bit of fun by keeping the camel logo of the Silk Road there in the background. Now, when the Silk Road was captured, I mean, how the guy was caught is, again, another fascinating story that I'm in the middle of writing for an update to my book. To me, it looks like the site was growing exponentially. It was a fantastic idea, you know. It had... he was out of control. He was extorted, he was provoked and blackmailed, and his response, says the FBI, was to solicit the murder of his opponents, up to six of them, at the latest hearing. But 1 million accounts were on that site. There were 1 million people buying illegal drugs across the internet. And just a few years ago, this kind of thing, I've been following this kind of thing for 5 years, there were maybe a couple of hundred. And now it's 1 million. And now that there's 1 million, and now that how many people in this room know about it, this really is the future of the illegal drugs market. You know, the legal highs question, I think it's a key issue. But I think that this really is the direction that things are going. Because, you know, you cannot kill an idea whose time has come. And this was on October the 2nd, and then this was 5 weeks later. This hidden site has risen again. So now the Silk Road is back online. And it's not only the Silk Road that's back online. There's also another 8 different markets. There's one on the I2P network, you know. There's completely different protocols being used to host and to create markets and websites to sell drugs. So, you know, it's got the same drugs for sale. This site, there we go, this is, I've got this morning, cannabis, dissociative, ecstasy, opioids. There's a couple of thousand different drugs for sale there, different deals. And then, you know, there's a gram of MDMA for just £53. Some tablets of from the US of some MDMA. And these are all priced up accordingly. And then, you know, there's some heroin. If you want some heroin there, you can buy that on the Silk Road, nice and easy. Just £10, nice £9.99 deal there for first-time heroin users. So, you know, cocaine, yeah, there's a 0.1 of a gram for a sample, so you can buy some cocaine before you commit to a larger gram. So, if you look at all of these things, you've got to say, you know, who are we dealing with? And the guy that we're dealing with is this guy. This is Ross Ulbricht. Now, these are intelligent people. They're hackers, they're coders, they're libertarians, and some of them, they're even futurists. And so, you know, this is the guy. He ran a billion-dollar global empire from his laptop. Who is he? He's a physics grad from Texas. I mean, there is polymeric solar cells with oriented and strong transparent carbon nanotubes. Mr. Ulbricht, peer-reviewed physicist. So we're dealing with some of the brightest young men. You know, he's a coder. Here's a piece of code that got him caught. How can you connect to a Tor hidden service using Kale and PHP? The FBI actually traced back his login on this account to a number of different names that he registered and didn't register. He was quite careless in certain ways. And so, you know, there's this awful cliche that drug dealers and drug users are kind of deviant, dumb, or deranged. And many of them aren't. You know, this is just an othering, to use the sort of sociological terminology, it's an othering of drug users to make their crimes feel more acceptable to clamp down upon. And so, you know, these are bright, passionate, ambitious people who are dedicating themselves to circumventing international drug control. And, you know, he might be in jail, but his idea is free. And if we look at, you know, let's look at this graph. Look at that graph. That's a graph for Bitcoin. That's from May 2012. And that's bumping around about $7 when I was thinking about buying some. And then we go along, and that's stops in April, actually. April 2013, and that's at $130. Look at that exponential rise. It's a parabolic curve. And then consider that a Bitcoin sold just a couple of days ago for $1,130, an increase of 10 on that exponential rise in the space of a few months. So this is the way that I see parts of the drug market and the web kind of extending. And, you know, I think that what's interesting is that this is a story that whether or not you think it concerns you, it concerns every single one of us in this room. Because, you know, I spoke to a security expert on Silk Road just this morning, and he made me think about the issue of privacy and drug use and drug dealing in a way that I had thought about, but I thought was really good to share today. And he argued that it concerns us all, and here's how he put it to me. He said, "It would appear that the mere existence of sites like Silk Road and perhaps the forums is seen by the authorities as justification to strip the entire citizenry of any shreds of privacy that they may still happen to possess, while at the same time they wrap themselves in the most impenetrable cloaks of secrecy." And he said, "I'm a child of the Cold War. My father and uncles donned uniforms when war was declared in 1939. Both of my spouse's parents were in uniform as well. They went over to Europe to fight the type of fascist crap that we are now told is necessary to protect us or protect the children. Look at the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, Part 3. Look at the American Patriot Act." He says, "When I was growing up, like so many others of my generation, I was told repeatedly that we were free and that authorities trawling through people's reading habits at the library only happened in Soviet Russia." And he continues and says, "I remember well that even as late as the 1980s, when Nicolae Ceaușescu was literally excoriated in the Western press because his regime had a handful of cameras surveilling the population of Bucharest, one is led to wonder what he would have made of modern Britain with 4 million cameras." So to conclude, I think there are two strands to gather and sort of close together in the discussion of legal and illegal drugs on the internet. And I'd say that, you know, we've looked at the way the legal hires market has emerged and where it's gone. We've looked at the emergence of Bitcoin and Silk Road and where that's going. And really, the way I see it is that over the course of the century or so that drug laws have existed in any meaningful form, a clear pattern has emerged, and it's this. As each law to prevent drug consumption is made, a means to circumvent it is thought and found. And those means can be chemical, legal, social, or technological. And we stand today at a crossroads formed by those four elements, with the web making possible communication between distant strangers, facilitating the sharing of limitless quantities of information, and enabling now the distribution of drugs anywhere in the world. And so where do we go next? So I do argue that in 2013 it's time for change. It's time to change the drug laws that have failed to reduce consumption. They've failed to kill demand. They've failed to reduce harm. They've failed to reduce supply. They've failed to prevent the proliferation and emergence of ever more dangerous drugs in society. One of the guys I was talking to, Dr. Caldicott, he said to me, let's see drugs as an illness and let's see prohibition as an antibiotic. If you treated any illness with the same antibiotic for 50 years, medical people would be stunned if resistance hadn't developed. And that's what's happened. So the only reason that legal highs exist is because of the drug laws. So more laws banning them is not the answer. And instead of uncontrolled substances, we need controlled substances. And if it seems unthinkable that we can have such a dramatic change as that, you know, if we can have supply, distribution, and purity and consumption regulated and have that taxed and controlled and have the population educated to the harms of drug use, if that seems unthinkable, then, you know, let's go back to look at something that happened in Colombia just last week. You know, the Colombian Civil War has raged for 50 years and 50,000 people have died in the Colombian Civil War, all driven by drugs since about 1970, since before the era of Pablo Escobar. And just 2 weeks ago, Ivan Marquez of the FARC told the Reuters news agency that the FARC is intent on putting down its weapons. An unthinkable change, but change can happen. And so Ivan Marquez said, we have taken an important step in the right direction to end the conflict and to achieve a real democracy here in Colombia. And I believe that if the civil war in Colombia can be negotiated to an end in my lifetime, with all of the blood, the bitter enmity, with all of the money involved, the entrenched divisions, if that war can be dismantled, then I remain really optimistic that the leaders in Latin America, who are currently so bravely suggesting in defiance of the US that we overhaul our outdated drug laws with all of their unintended consequences, then we might just succeed, and we might, after 40 years of pointless, pyrrhic, endless war on drugs, then we might at some point see some peace. And that's that.